Hack the Entrepreneur is part of Rainmaker FM, the digital business podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm. Today, I'd like to tell you about designcrowd.com. Designcrowd is a website that helps entrepreneurs and small businesses outsource or crowdsource their custom graphic, logo, and web design from designers around the world. Designcrowd has more than 500,000 designers from over 100 countries ready to help you with any creative and design projects you might have. Check out designcrowd.com to learn more and get started, or designcrowd.com/hack to get a special VIP offer for you as a Hack the Entrepreneur listener.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is focused on the intersection of technology and intelligence. He's an author, black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and an entrepreneur. While still an undergrad, he started his first brick-and-mortar business, subsequently selling it at the age of 25. This move led to e-commerce, where he founded Science of Skill, a seven-figure online publishing company. He's also the founder of Tech Emergence and is dedicated entirely to the ethical implications of cognitive enhancement at the intersection of technology and psychology. Now, let's hack. Dan Figella. Hack the Entrepreneur is sponsored by Citi Cards with Android Pay. How cool is it that we live in a world where you can use the same device to listen to Hack the Entrepreneur and buy your morning coffee, groceries, and more? And did I mention that it's a super fast way to pay? Just use your Citi card with Android Pay at the register. Get in. Get it. Get going. Download the Android Pay app on Google Play or visit citi.com/AndroidPay to get started. Android Pay is available for eligible Citi consumer credit and debit cards. We're back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Glad to be here, man.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this.
Oh, I bet.
Nice. Let's do it. Dan, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Oh, man. You know, that's the one thing that I do. See, that's tough. I'd say if there's anything at all, John, if there's like a place to start for successes in any given category, it's probably just taking a look at who historically has sort of been the best there. That started for me in the martial arts world, wanting to sort of win tournaments. It's sort of like, man, well, who goes out there and wins tournaments? And then in business, the natural question was, you know, like, hey, I want to have a business that's successful doing XYZ. All right, well, you know, who does that but makes, you know, hundreds of millions? And so looking at sort of who the winners are is something that, you know, in any given venture, I think is a good place to start. It's not a good place to end. You don't want to sort of limit yourself by what others have done. But I think for me, John, if there's anything at all that sort of helped with a good trajectory into new projects and ventures, figuring out kind of who the big dogs are, the best winners historically in that space, that's just a good habit to be in.
Nice. I like it. So I just want to tell you, when I started this show like 250 episodes ago,
jeez,
I still have it on the bottom of my my notes right now for questions. It's called the Tony Robbins method, which is something I wrote on this sheet before I'd ever interviewed anybody in my life.
What is it?
And it's step one is there's five steps. First one, at first you don't know anything, right? We all don't.
Yeah. No.
But you want to, like you said. So step two is you find five people who are the absolute best experts in the world in that field. Then you extensively interview them. Then you figure out the most simple things they have in common with each other. And then you do that simple thing over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, you know, they you could call it the Tony Robbins method, but I mean, there's a Bonaparte now, and I love Robbins. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I have tremendous respect for Robbins, I'll say. I mean, but, you know, Bonaparte himself, you know, said something along the lines of, paraphrasing, of course, he said in French, but read over and over and over again the campaigns of Hannibal and Frederick the Great and Alexander, and you will become a great general. And so that was, of course, what he was doing as well, right? So that's a pretty old thing to pull off. But I like that Robbins kind of distilled it down as well. That's cool that he sort of has a process for it.
Right. Everything, I mean, I'm sure everything he says comes from somebody else, but it was, that's how it is on my sheet. And at the very top of my sheet, it says to master anything, talk to the experts.
That's awesome. Yeah, so that's where I started.
Yeah. Like, are you looking to sort of emulate the ideas, or are you looking, like, for jiu-jitsu? I know nothing about jiu-jitsu, but, like, what would you pick from those top people and be able to sort of emulate without sort of that 10,000 hours of practice behind you?
Perfect. I know I've definitely logged in my 10,000 for Brazilian jiu-jitsu over time, but I mean, I wasn't at 10,000 when I first started trying to figure out who is the best. I mean, in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, interestingly enough, so I'm a lightweight, like I actually walk around at like 120 something pounds. So I'm a pretty small fella. So what I did, John, is I looked at who are the best sort of very lightweight Brazilian jiu-jitsu multi-time world champions, and who are the best lightweight multi-time world champions who also compete in absolute division. So I used to do a lot of tournaments, John, where I'd be up against dudes, you know, like division one wrestlers who are like 200 something pounds. And I want to figure out who are the historical champions who've won against a lot of bigger opponents. And so what I did is I just watched a lot of competition footage and then figured out commonalities, figured out sort of techniques that were viable, techniques that weren't, maybe principles that tied those techniques together. And that sort of helped me define what am I going to drill and what am I going to train and practice on a regular basis? You know, if realistically, this list of six techniques is going to account for 80% of the submissions against someone twice my size, maybe I ought to be drilling the ever-loving, you know, crap out of that stuff and really just focusing there. And so I did a lot of study of, you know, how do the best lightweight jiu-jitsu champions sort of beat bigger opponents and watch them lose, watch them win, and figured out what I needed to do in order to compete against bigger guys, which is what I did for many years. And that sort of refined my drilling strategy. In addition to that, John, I flew all over the place. I mean, I drove up and down the East Coast, and I, you know, flew down to Brazil, and I trained with all these guys that I could, like all the multi-time world champions that I could get my hands on. And I would videotape it, and I would take notes like to death, and I would show up with a massive list of questions. And so I would interview them. I would pay for private lessons. Like, even when I didn't have the money, I was like, you know, 21. It's like paying, you know, way too much probably for private lessons at 21-year-old, and just picking their brains. And at the same time, sort of compiling, you know, like you had mentioned, what are their commonalities? What are the techniques that tie these things together that really seem to be sort of the most logical fit? And that's how I did that. And when I started Science of Skill, which is the e-commerce business that we have now in the self-defense space, scienceofskill.com, basically I asked myself, John, who's making the most money selling subscription information in a particular affinity or sports related market? And where I started was actually Sports Illustrated. You, as people tuned in may or may not know, Sports Illustrated does about $1 billion in revenue.
Wow.
Which is good, right? So like a lot of people who get into, you know, a quote unquote online publishing business, they'll like find your local internet marketing guru or like your Frank Kern or something, and they'll be like, man, that's the pinnacle of winning. But it's really not actually. There's people that make $1 billion. And like Frank Kern's cool, but Frank Kern don't make $1 billion. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I totally know what you're saying.
So it's all good. Like, God bless Frank Kern, John, but he don't make no $1 billion. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So I started off with Sports Illustrated because they make $1 billion. And because I have a Silicon Valley venture to fund out here, you know, I wanted to find something that I knew would scale, that I really would feel optimistic about. And so I looked at, John, I looked at how do they sell subscriptions? How do they do email promotions? How do they organize their homepage? What are their calls to action? You know, how do they tie in subscription, like calls to action to buy subscriptions inside their actual content, web and print? And I just studied everything those freaking guys do. And I started with those principles to get this little tiny, you know, now we're doing, you know, multiple millions a year, but little tiny internet marketing business off the ground 3 years ago. I just studied, you know, Sports Illustrated because I said, well, apparently they're the winners. So same kind of principle, you know?
I like that. If you're going to reach for something, you might as well reach for the stars rather than like the street light above you.
Yeah. And well, it depends on your goals, right? I mean, everybody's got their own goals, but you know, given my objectives, my sort of, they have certain requirements.
It's a good mindset shift. I like it. It's further in the distance. You might as well reach that far. So You're currently running Tech Emergence and Science of Skill.
You bet.
But I know these aren't your first ventures, so
no.
We need to go back if we can, Dan.
Okay, let's totally
when we go
do
back,
it.
There seems to be this time in every entrepreneur's life when they've realized one of two things, that either they had this calling to make this huge difference in the world, or, as mostly seems to be the case, they just find they cannot work for somebody else anymore.
Yeah.
So could you take me back to that time and then tell me which side of the fence you see yourself on?
Man, you know, I definitely had both realizations. So I'll hit you with these, John. So the reason I started having my own business, I was an undergraduate at University of Rhode Island. The reason I had my own company originally was because I was teaching at a martial arts academy and I was teaching for free. Now, you might ask why I was teaching for free. It didn't start that way. It's because the guy was going out of business and I just didn't know about it. So he was like kind of having to defer his payments to me for a while. And so I was teaching for free at this martial arts academy. And then all of a sudden the guy kind of went under. And he basically said, which was actually pretty nice of him, he said, hey, you know, you've been teaching here for free for, you know, a year. You know, I haven't paid you anything in the last year. You can have the mats. So the mats that you roll on and that you train on in jiu-jitsu are definitely not cheap. And these were used, but they were still pretty good. And so he said, hey, you can have the mats. So I was like, man, I got mats. What the hell am I going to do now? And I had nowhere to train now because the place where I was training went out of business. So I started a business in the back of a carpet store. I just rolled out the jiu-jitsu mats. I rented, you know, I basically paid for the heat in the back of this carpet store and, you know, started training jiu-jitsu back there. And that was my first business, partially out of necessity because I needed to train, also partially because, as you mentioned before, I couldn't, you know, didn't do so good sort of being an employee and needed to have that autonomy. The other realization though, John, while I was in graduate school, which is while I was running that martial arts academy, was that sort of the future. I was always interested in sports psychology and human potential. And I realized that the furthest reaches of human potential within my lifetime, I don't believe are going to be by developing new methods of, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy or, you know, some new Freudian schemata. I think the further developments in human potential are going to be through technology, through neuroscience and sort of augmentation, and also through artificial intelligence. And I came to believe that those are the most sort of morally heavy conceivable topics within my lifetime, at least in my own belief structure, and that influencing kind of global policy around how we start to tinker with ourselves and how smart we make our machines over the next 30, 40 years might be about as grand a contribution as one could make. And so that was the impetus to do the Silicon Valley shebang. But initially it was just because I just wanted to fight and train people, and I didn't really want to, you know, deliver pizzas.
Fair enough. So it started out as a necessity and now it's become more like a big thing. Like you want to change and make a difference.
Yeah. Like it became very much a grand purposive moral endeavor, without a doubt, sort of an all consuming grand purposive moral endeavor. But it very much began as like, man, I guess I could teach people, you know. It started off as like a 20-year-old kid just kind of having that thought.
So how long into the back of a carpet store? It's basically like you had a skill set, you wanted to train, you had the mat, so you just started it.
Yep.
But I'm sure there was an area or like time span in there where you didn't even really realize you were a quote unquote entrepreneur at this
totally.
Point.
Totally. You're right. Yep.
So like how did that development, like did something happen sort of a year into it or 2 years and you're like, oh wow, this is like I'm an entrepreneur. I have my own business here.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So I really didn't see myself truly as like an entrepreneur, right? I saw myself as a guy who is somehow, you know, getting by simply, you know, teaching martial arts. And I thought that was fortunate, but I didn't see myself really as an entrepreneur. There was one day where, well, there was two things that help with that. At some point I realized, man, I really need to learn how to like actually have like a sales process. Cause in the beginning it was just like some new dude would walk in the door. Right. And you got to think about it, John, like we're in the back of a carpet store. Like there's carpet dust all over the place. It's hard concrete. There was a forklift parked in the corner. This thing was made in like 1974. It was like the oldest, most intimidating, just ugly, oily, dirty machine in like the corner of this room. And we have mats rolled out in this cement and we're like beating the crap out of each other, right? And people would walk in and basically they would just join in like the crap beatings for 3 hours. And then at the end, I'd be like, yeah, you know, if you want to kind of continue to hang out with us, it's like $100 a month and that's it. And I would kind of, you know, that was it, right? There was no introductory lesson or particular sales method or anything like that. And I realized I needed something like that. So learning a basic, there was a guy locally in Rhode Island where I come from who did some sales training and happened to actually be one of my private lesson students. And he sort of taught me a basic framework for kind of sales, like presenting the value of your offering and maybe having a little bit more of an introductory lesson so people don't have to just jump into the fray with the forklifts and the you know, big, strong guys. And so that helped a lot. And then the first day, I remember the first day was all cash in the early days because, you know, I was like 21 and didn't know that there was anything other than cash. And the first day that I collected $1,000 in cash payments in a day, we had like 20 people on the mats or something. And for whatever reason, between new sales and people paying for their monthly, which I kept track of, I'm sure, in like a spreadsheet in like a beat up laptop or something. There was like no way to know who's paid or not. Like I probably forgot about it 3/4 of the time because I just wanted to train. But I walked out with $1,000 in cash in a given day, which was not my number one objective, right? My number one objective was just to train because I had nowhere to train anymore. But when I left with like, I remember having to go home. I had somewhere to go after training. I remember having to go home and put this stuff in my sock drawer before I went out to where I was going because I was like, I don't want to carry $1,000 in cash. And I was like, huh, you know, maybe this could be a company, you know? And that's sort of when it dawned on me that I guess I could grow and sell that business. And that's exactly what I did. I grew that thing for another 2-3 years. And then I sold it to my highest in command.
I love it. I love it. And so at the beginning, you said that your one thing is being able to look at the best in a space and then sort of pull out their best parts and emulate those.
Heck yeah.
To kind of take over a space. So every business expert now talks about the 80-20 rule in business, Dan.
Yep.
You're supposed to do 20%, get 80% of the results, do what you're good at, delegate the rest. Dan, can you tell me something that you're absolutely not good at in your business?
Man, yeah. You know, well, I'll tell you one thing that I wasn't good at until recently that is stupid and that I recommend that anyone who feels this way stop feeling this way and just change yourself because otherwise you're not going to be an entrepreneur. And I'll chastise myself by saying this. And that was like until 2 years ago, you know, and I'd been in business for 5 years since then, you know, until 2 years ago, I would have said, you know, accounting, bookkeeping, like QuickBooks, like, oh God, you know, the math and all the silly tax stuff and yada, yada. But actually at a certain point, John, you just absolutely have to learn that stuff. And if you can't really get a pulse on your P&Ls and your balance sheet and whatnot all the time, you're really, really, really going to be hindered as an entrepreneur. Any entrepreneur who says, I'm not really a math guy or I don't really get that accounting stuff, really can only grow to so big and often is at huge financial risk if bad things happen. So I would have said that a couple of years ago, but now I've sort of nailed that. Where else am I terrible? I'm terrible at things that involve precision and a lot of little pieces. So video editing, John, really crappy at it, really crappy. Because I just can't, like, I start foaming at the mouth. Like, I want to go do sales or marketing. You know what I mean? Like, I can't edit videos. I just can't do it. And then another thing is, like, tracking data and spreadsheets. So I have a guy on my team. His name is Dylan, and he's the man. He's fantastic. Really, like, a perfection-driven guy. Like, he'll fill up our daily dashboard or our weekly dashboard with stats, like, to a T every single time. And, like, the second thing that I copy and paste, I'm, like, going crazy. Like, I can't do it. So anything that involves perfectionism and a lot of little tiny pieces, I tend to totally blow by. And I usually just like either do them in a really shoddy manner and move on to other things, or I just realize I have to delegate them. So one of the things I'm crappy at would be sort of that whole category.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And I like that you sort of admitted to yourself that accounting and bookkeeping was something that you weren't good at, but you had to learn. So did you find five people in that space and figure out what to do? Or did you actually just hire somebody or learn somewhere?
Yeah. A few things. I mean, YouTube actually was reasonably helpful. And then I also have this sort of remote bookkeeping and accounting firm that I work with out of Boston. And I basically just told them, hey, I want to talk with you guys every single week on the phone. And so I got on the phone every single week and I would just go look at QuickBooks. I would come up with every question I had and then I would just pound them with questions. You know, why does the cash flow statement look like this in the bottom line? And where does this number even come from? And why is this called retained earnings? And how much of this is going to taxes? And yada, yada, until I got a pulse, a sense, an understanding of what the true meaning and sort of interpretation of all these reports really was. And so for me, I have a good firm with a bookkeeper and accountant who I can talk to, both bookkeeper and an accountant, who I can talk to every week. I find a lot of bookkeepers by themselves maybe wouldn't necessarily be a fit for this, but with the CPA there, it was a little bit more helpful. And it was just cranking with questions, you know, a lot on YouTube, like, what is a cash flow statement? You know, 2 years ago, typing that into YouTube, like, I've looked at this twice in the last, you know, 5 years I've been in business. What the heck is this? So yeah, it was really just looking at the statements all the time, determining what I didn't understand, determining what I wanted to understand, and just weekly, every single week, it's at my time, 11 o'clock Pacific on Tuesday, I just talk to my team, the accounting team, every single week.
So that's
been my ritual.
Ask the experts again.
Yep. Yeah, pretty formulaic, I guess.
That's awesome, man. No, but it's also sort of being humble enough to admit that you don't. Lots of people, I think, wouldn't want to admit that to their CPA. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a business. I don't need to know it because I'm above it, blah, 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 or else you know what I mean? And you would just cover it up. You're just like, I need to know. Tell me what this means.
Honestly, and they tell me all the time, they're like, yep, basically none of the entrepreneurs we work with understand any of this stuff. Like, they're really straightforward about it. Because honestly, John, most entrepreneurs aren't, right? Most entrepreneurs, they want to run out into the world and create things. And frankly, John, most entrepreneurs have a penchant to sell stuff. Because you know what? If no one sells stuff, there ain't no freaking business.
Exactly.
So most entrepreneurs are pretty hungry to like actually go out and like feed themselves. And they're really into that. However, there is a point to which when you're past kind of survival threshold, you really need to understand sort of all of the Rockefeller once in speaking with Nelson Rockefeller, his grandchild. Nelson was talking about some of the innovative things they were doing to refine oil in Texas or something. And at this point, Rockefeller was like 85 years old. And he like listened to him and he was nodding. And then he was like, you know, son, it's the figures that matter. He just leaned into him and he said, you know, son, it's the figures that matter. And honestly, John, I think as an entrepreneur, I myself took too long. Luckily, I didn't have any tragic events. We have a multi-million-dollar e-commerce company. I sold my first business. I'm funding a venture out here in kind of the Bay Area. But at a certain point, kind of a maturity, you just realize, you know, son, it's the figures that matter. And so I had to understand the figures.
I love it. It's the figures that matter.
Yep.
And it's so true. So you just mentioned the two businesses that you're in, a business previously. I'm sure somebody like yourself comes up with a lot of ideas or else has ideas come through your inbox or you meet people when you're at conferences, et cetera.
Yep.
So
yep.
Let's talk projects, Dan.
Totally.
It can be a big brand new project or a project within an existing business.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love it right now if you could tell me what your process is and whether it's a written process or just an internal gut feeling. But what's your process when an idea comes through your head or through your inbox? What's the process that you personally go through to decide that it's worth your time, energy, and resources?
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, one thing that I go through, I've mentioned this on a number of occasions elsewhere, I think, how much I just really like this book. But there's a book called Scaling Up by Vern Harnish, same guy who wrote Rockefeller Habits. And Scaling Up is, they just talk about a lot of the companies that Gazelles, which is sort of a big international coaching and kind of business organization. They do a lot of like conferences and events and things like that. A lot of the companies that they work with, bigger, like, you know, $100 million companies that get acquired for like $500,000 and crazy stuff like that. And I read this over a year ago. And before had a vague sense of sort of annual goals, John, but now every quarter I get together with my teams and I set very succinct quarterly objectives in addition to refining annual goals. And the way that I sift through projects is the same way that I determine my weekly actions. And that is to answer the following question generally, is this going to get me to knocking dead the rocks that I need to knock dead to hit my quarterly goals and to get to my annual goals? If it's something maybe even more important than what I had on my quarterlies because it fits into my annuals, it fits into like the purpose, the cause, the big deal, then maybe sometimes it can supersede it. But for the most part, I put it through the filter of, is this going to get me to that next notch that I've already determined? You know, I don't have like a general gut sense that, man, I should really grow. I have more of like a benchmarked set of numbers on business ratios that I want to see changed. And, you know, customer list size that I want to see lifted to a certain percent based on like previous growth and things along those lines. So for me, I think picking weekly goals and picking projects themselves, really, it all goes through the filter of the hard thinking, which is done once per quarter /once per year. So if I had to do the hard thinking all the time, I'd have to constantly assess the big game. What I try to do is assess the big game with my entire team once a quarter and then things either plug into that like Lego bricks or they don't. And then every quarter we revise those, but it makes interim week by week decision making much faster. So that's the way that I think about it.
I love it. So much more structured than I expected, but I think that's what keeps you focused and going to where you are going and already are.
Yeah. And I'm totally not naturally a structured guy, by the way. I'm like, you know, could never track anything, could never look at QuickBooks, could never, like, everything was always hodgepodge and all over the place, but I just had to kind of grow up. And this is one of the things that has sort of helped us, I think, grow up.
I love it. All right, Dan, it's been a lot of fun. I want to wrap up on one final question for you.
Let's do it.
This idea I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap, meaning that there, no matter what we accomplish, personally, we always see our successes and project our successes into the future. So in 1 month, when you hit that metric, in the next quarter, in the next year, when you get to stand on that stage or hit that revenue metric, that's when you'll see yourself as successful. Yet we both know, Dan, that right before you hit those goals, you're going to set bigger, loftier ones into the future.
Yeah.
Which I agree that you have to, and you probably agree too. But like walking towards the horizon, the further you walk, the further away it always gets. From the outside, Dan, you look like you've been a success already. But I know that we see it differently to ourselves. So we live in this gap where we never, ever are successful. So I would love it right now if you could look back. You've been at this entrepreneurial game for about 6 or 7 years now. You've had some huge successes along the way. But I would love if you could look at the wins, the losses, the highs, the lows, and tell me how you feel about your journey up until this moment.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's going far there, John. This is interesting stuff. So yes, I will say that is one of the, you know, facets of the human experience, is this hedonic treadmill on which we, you know, tread, for lack of better terms, where, you know, unfortunately, despite all of our modern conveniences, which are basically magical and kind of deity level compared to our, you know, great, great, great ancestors, we sort of, you know, ever-present fulfillment evades us. But this is sort of, again, part of the human shtick. May or may not be forever, as, you know, neuroscience picks up, but for right now, it is. How do I feel about things thus far? You know, to be honest, John, I mean, I think I'm confident in the direction that I'm headed, but I would have wished to get into sort of the emerging technology side of things a little bit earlier on. I was under the belief in the early days that if I started a business, Science of Skill at the time, and we got to 5 figures a month in recurring revenue, we could sell it as soon as we wanted to. So we got to 40 grand a month in the first 14 months, and I was like, oh man, this thing's totally going to sell. But then it took like another, you know, now more than 2 years in order to sort of get there. Now we've continued to grow, continue to double in size, you know, doing like a couple hundred thousand a month now. But, you know, I'm sort of there now, still spending a good amount of time instead of entirely focused on market research and eventually public policy on technology, which is really what I'm into. So, you know, how do I feel about it? I mean, I feel good overall. You know, I just feel excited to be able to have more focus once I sort of exit my e-commerce venture, I guess. I don't see any of it as significant. You had mentioned huge wins. I don't really see them as huge. I read a lot of biography. And when I sort of, you know, put what I've done up against the biographies that I'm interested in, it's not a really big deal. So I'm just interested in making it a big deal by anchoring all of it towards sort of a grander moral purpose and working hard. So feel okay about it. Excited just to progress, basically. I mean, I don't know if that cuts the mustard for you, but that's sort of my inkling as to what I've done thus far.
I love it, man. Beautiful answer.
All right.
So we've got to talk about your business in passing, Dan.
Yep.
Two businesses. Could you now specifically tell the listener about the business and where to find them? And then if there's a place on social media where they could track you down?
Yeah. I mean, well, the companies that people probably are, you know, may or may not be that interested in. Scienceofskill.com is my online self-defense publishing business. There's a really where I do my writing on like businessy stuff is clvboost.com. So that stands for customer lifetime value, clvboost.com. Basically, all that we've done to grow a multi-million dollar company in the last 3.5 years in Science of Skill has been basically email marketing, marketing automation, and really improving conversion rate. And that's like on clvboost.com, I basically have like everything that I've ever done in that category. So if people are into like, man, how did this guy sell martial arts on the internet and make a couple million bucks? You know, they would go to clvboost.com. And then if they want to find me really in terms of, you know, social media, just at Dan Fagella on Twitter is probably the best way to hang out. And I'm always happy to answer questions.
I love it. So clvboost.com, at Dan Fagella on Twitter. then techemergence.com and Science of Skill.
You bet.
As well as the book by Vern someone called Scaling Up.
Vern Harnish. Yes, Vern Harnish. Yeah, you can Google it. It's a good one. Yeah. Definitely recommend it. Excellent.
I'll link to that as well in the show notes, as well as Sports Illustrated. So you can compare Science of Skill to Sports Illustrated.
I'm not there yet, John. One day.
But that's where you're heading. And I love that that's sort of the goal where you're looking.
I looked at them 4 years ago. I said, man, that's the anchor point. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. All right, Dan, once again, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you so much for sharing so openly. And please just keep doing what you're doing, man, because it is awesome and inspiring to watch.
Hey, same to you, John. Thanks so much, bro.
Dan, thank you so much for joining me. That was a really, really, really fun conversation. I love your energy. I love your unique perspective on business and on just building things. It's cool. I really, really, really dug that. I hope you out there listening got as much out of that as I did. I really do. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I wonder, like, were you taking notes? I took a lot of notes. I took, like, I have a page that's literally all the margins, everything's full. And so I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 spots that I had to go back and listen to just really kind of digest what Dan said. So I went back and I listened. And then I got down to 5 things. And then I went back again. I got down to 3. Then I got down to 2. And then I went back one more time. And the last time I went through, it was so very, very clear that one thing that Dan said. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
At a certain point, John, you just absolutely have to learn that stuff. And if you can't really get a pulse on your P&Ls and your balance sheet and whatnot all the time, you're really, really, really going to be hindered as an entrepreneur. Any entrepreneur who says, I'm not really a math guy or I don't really get that accounting stuff, really can only grow to so big. And often is at huge financial risk if bad things happen.
And that's the hack. Dan. I love this answer. And I love it for 2 reasons. One, I love it because you're absolutely right that you have to understand that basics of the business to grow beyond a certain point and not to put yourself into some sort of jeopardy. P&Ls, balance sheets, the basic fundamentals of how money comes in and goes. But then the other part of it is how a couple years ago you would have just been like, I'm not that kind of a math guy. And we talk about that a lot in this show. Like, what are you good at? What are you not good at? Lots of us aren't good, quote unquote, we're not math people necessarily if we're creators or entrepreneurs, but you got to merge those two and you have to, I guess it's almost like maturing in an entrepreneurial sort of business way, knowing that you have to accept it's, there's all these things about like only do what you're good at and ignore the rest. And as much as that is true to certain things, you do have to know enough about these essential aspects of your business if you want to take them and scale them to the places that I know you want to take them to, that I think we all want to take them to in one way or another. So I love how you've changed this mindset. You've realized that you have to learn this. And it's none of us are born innately knowing this. So it's not like you should just feel uncomfortable not knowing it. Like if you have an accountant, ask your accountant to take once a week or once a month to spend an hour with you and just sort of go over stuff and really make you deeply understand if that's what it takes. Go to Khan Academy for free. And there's lessons on this stuff. It shouldn't be embarrassing. It's just something that you should get better at. You should be more just like educated within it. It will help you understand these aspects of your business, which will help you grow and get to where you want to grow. Dan, thank you so very much. All right. That was a lot of fun. This has been good. HackTheEntrepreneur.com is the website. This is August 23rd, I believe, 2016. This is coming out. If you're listening to this recently or in the next week or two, then you'll notice that about the last 10 episodes I haven't put the show notes up yet, but they are coming up shortly. I went through sort of a staff change and then I broke my elbow. Yeah. And I couldn't actually type until today. Of course, it was my dominant hand and everything. And yeah, it sucked. I was riding a skateboard. So you don't have to feel too bad for me, but it has sort of slowed that part of the production. But I will be catching up shortly, and will be with this episode of Dan's. So anytime around August 23rd, 2016, give me a week or so and we'll get totally caught up in the backlog, and it will be there for you. But that's just to let you know what sort of happened. Yeah, I don't know. It happens. I've never broken a bone in my life before. Well, actually, now I have. I could say that before, but it's summertime. These things happen. All right. It's been fun. Thank you so very much for stopping by. You know that I very much appreciate it. Stop by Twitter, John Naster, or email me, john@hacktheentrepreneur, if you want to say hi or have something to tell me. Yeah, I'd like to hear from you. All right. Take care. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.